Welcome. This is a Zero Point Radio Hour, Radio 2 Hours. My name is Jim Moffat. Those of you who listen to the show regularly know that I'm Christopher Holmes' co-host. And generally, Christopher is hosting the program, but today he's in Ottawa, in Ontario, Canada, nation's capital, at the Canadian Action Party Convention. And Canadian Action Party is the is a very small but growing party in Canada, political party in Canada, which is the only party which questions the truth of 9/11 and which is the only party which has any kind of platform which challenges most of the working assumptions that all of the other parties share in Canada despite their political differences. And so Christopher's attending the convention, and it's very actively becoming more and more actively involved in the Canadian Action Party and supporting its program. And so he may, I'm hoping he's going to call in today to give us a report and to update us as to what's happening. But in lieu of that, I'll be doing the program today. I'll be speaking about a number of things. And later on the hour, at 5 o'clock Eastern Time, I guess that's, 2 o'clock Pacific Time, we'll have a guest who is also involved with the Canadian Action Party, Mark from Ottawa. He's been on the program before with Christopher. Unfortunately, I didn't hear Mark's previous broadcast, but he will be calling in, and we'll be discussing we'll be discussing the Canadian Action Party, but also we'll be discussing a recent lecture which Dr. David Ray Griffin gave in Ottawa on Thursday on the subject of 9/11. And I was fortunate enough to have attended this lecture with Christopher and Mark. I drove up to Ottawa from Toronto. I'm in Toronto. Christopher's in Carrs, Ontario, which is about 30 miles outside of Ottawa. And we attended Dr. Griffin's lecture, which was extremely informative, extremely provocative, and we'll definitely review some of the questions that he raised. I don't know to what extent members of our audience are aware of David Ray Griffin. He's a prominent academic, philosopher, theologian, who has written or edited many, many books, and who was, in about 2001, was writing a book on democracy. And from an ethical, philosophical perspective, more than a political perspective, I believe. And he decided that he needed to include a chapter on, he was considering the topic of worldwide democracy, and he felt that if he's going to address this issue properly, that he had to include a chapter on American imperialism. And as a result of his research into quote-unquote American imperialism, he began to study the official account of 9/11. And he says that despite his misgivings about the Bush and Cheney administration, he was of the mind that the official representation of what had happened on 9/11 was, in fact, the truth, and he didn't really question it. But as he began to study some of the dissenting opinions and some of the critiques that had been raised about the investigation and subsequent solving of the crime of 9/11, he began to become very, very skeptical. And he, in 2003, he published a book, The New Pearl Harbor. And in that book, he raises a number of very upsetting and provocative questions as to the official version of 9/11, the American government's explanation that a group of Muslim hijackers flew planes into the World Trade Center, both buildings of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and took thousands of people's lives. And as he studied it, he began to realize that the official story, when subjected to any kind of impartial and objective scrutiny, just doesn't hold water. And in his book, in The New Pearl Harbor, Dr. Griffin essentially says, look, I don't know what happened, but you know, my attitude in examining this is to question the official version of things, and that's what I'm interested in doing. I'm not supplying the answers. I'm considering various levels of possible involvement of the American government, because it seems to me that this is what the facts point to. But I'm not drawing any conclusions at this point. So since then, 2003, Dr. Griffin has very courageously and very prodigiously been examining the 9/11 official story, and has been perhaps his most prominent critic, and has written several books and edited another on the subject. And as I say, we'll discuss more about this later on, but I just wanted to put people on note that we were going to discuss 9/11 and Dr. David Ray Griffin. And before we turn to some other things, I want to point out a couple of websites that in his lecture Dr. Griffin made reference to these websites, and I came home and have just checked them out. And I wasn't aware of these. Those of you who are more informed about the 9/11 truth movement will undoubtedly know about these, but I would urge people to check out these two websites. The first is called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. That's pilotsfor911truth.org. And the second is Patriots Question 9/11. And again, it's 9 without the slash, it's just 911.com. So the second one is patriotsquestion911.com. And I would, as I say, I would urge people to check these websites out. I think those of you who are perhaps of the camp that the critique and the critics of the official 9/11 story is nothing more than the delusions and fertile imagination of conspiracy theorists, really should go and see who some of these conspiracy theorists are. It's quite shocking to see the number of prominent people from various walks of life, many of which are involved in the military and politics, who are very skeptical about the official version. You'd never know that watching American television or reading American newspapers or prominent magazines. One of the things I found very interesting in listening to Dr. Griffin talk is that he has a variety of shorter versions of his critique, and he's tried to get these into mainstream American media publications without any success. And the title of his lecture the other night, which is going to be produced in his forthcoming book, is 16 Questions About 9/11. And he goes through 16 essential questions that we have to ask about 9/11. And as I say, I found this to be a very compelling and very provocative presentation of his critique and his questions regarding the official version of things. And at the very least, I don't see how any open-minded, objective or impartial questioner of the official account could not be disturbed by some of the issues he raises. They're just too overwhelming in terms of their content. So I just wanted to read a little bit from the Pilots for 9/11 Truth. This is just at the beginning of their webpage. It says, Pilots for 9/11 Truth is an organization of aviation professionals and pilots throughout the globe who have gathered together for one purpose. We are committed to seeking the truth surrounding the events of the 11th of September 2001. Our main focus concentrates on the four flights, maneuvers performed, and the reported pilots. And they have this underlined. We do not offer a theory or point blame at this point in time. However, we are focused on determining the truth of that fateful day based on solid data and facts, since 9/11/2001 is the catalyst for so many of the events shaping our world today, and the United States government doesn't seem to be very forthcoming with answers or facts. That's one of the great understatements of all time. Continuing, they say, we stand with the scholars, veterans, and architects and engineers for truth, alongside family members of the victims, family members of soldiers who have made the ultimate sacrifice, including the many ground zero workers who are now ill or who have passed away, when we ask for a true, new, independent investigation into the events of 9/11. We do not accept the 9/11 Commission report and or hypothesis as a satisfactory explanation for the sacrifice every American has made and continues to make, some more than others. And it concludes, thank you for taking the time to inform yourself. And as I say, I would urge people to check this out. It's a very interesting website. And even more interesting in terms of just the sheer content of it, I think, is the Patriots Quest in 9/11.com. Very, very interesting. Now, in terms of the history of the Zero Point program, I guess we've been on the air for, I think it's about over three years now. And the focus of the program is Christopher Holmes is a clinical and forensic psychologist who has written a number of books about esoteric and mystical perspectives on the nature of consciousness. And over the last, I guess, 30 years, Christopher has studied a variety of mystical and esoteric teachings. He began with Gurdjieff's Fourth Way teaching, but has also studied extensively the Vedas, Sufi teachings, Christian mysticism, the work of Heart Master Adida, and most prominently in recent years, Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical teaching. And from that, he has developed a model of consciousness, which I think is not only a psychological model, but a model which is has profound cosmological, excuse me, losing my voice here, profound cosmological implications. And in doing so, he has integrated both the ancient mystical and esoteric perspectives with modern physics, particularly modern science in general, and modern psychology. And he's used in for the most part, he's used the mystical and esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness to critique the modern psychological study of consciousness, what he refers to as the head doctrine. And essentially what the head doctrine means in Christopher's terminology is that modern psychology and science assumes that consciousness is the product of the neurochemical processes occurring within the brain, that it's somehow consciousness is produced by the material processes in the brain. Now, although this is widely accepted, this is widely assumed within modern psychology and science, the evidence for this idea is precisely zero. There is no compelling evidence to suggest that consciousness is produced by the brain. Everyone thinks it is, or pretty much everyone in modern psychology and science thinks that it is, but as Stanislav Grof, a prominent psychiatrist and consciousness theorist, has suggested, this is really one of the fundamental and most important epistemological assumptions, an assumption about how we know, which modern science and psychology has embraced, but which really is based on no evidentiary basis. There isn't any compelling brain research or evidence derived from studies of the brain, which in any way can account for or explain how consciousness, the experience of our awareness of ourselves and the world, is somehow produced by the brain. Now, you might say, well, you know, if you don't have a brain, you can't be conscious. Well, that's probably true. That's, for the most part, true. But that doesn't imply that consciousness is indeed produced by the brain. And so what Christopher argues in his work is that this is an assumption, and it's one that's wrong about consciousness. And in its place, what he argues, which is based on his study of extensive variety of sources in the mystical and esoteric tradition, the idea of the heart doctrine, and what he suggests, and this is something that he's derived from years of study, but if you look at all of the esoteric teachings associated with the great religions, with all of the major religions, and if you look at various esoteric schools, what you'll see is a common repetition, consistent representation of the idea that the consciousness and life in the human being is somehow emerges from the heart. Now, this is a very, very complicated proposition, but to simplify it, what it means is that consciousness is somehow produced out of the heart, out of the physical and metaphysical heart, because what's being suggested is that consciousness, rather than arising out of any material process in the material world, is rather is transformed from higher dimensions, that that its source is in higher dimensions to which human beings are connected, and that that this consciousness manifests from a point source or a singularity which is rooted into the higher dimensions and which is located in both the physical and the metaphysical heart. And that in esoteric teachings, consciousness is the consciousness of the heart is generally likened to the sun. Like it's inherently self-illuminating. This phrase recurs in various mystical and esoteric traditions. In contrast, the mind centered in the brain or in the head is likened to the moon. It has no light of its own. Rather, it reflects the light of the heart. So in the mystical esoteric conceptualization, which Christopher has termed the heart doctrine, when he actually derived that, I believe, from Madame Blavatsky speaks in those terms, consciousness originates in the heart, is self-illuminating, and it casts its light on the material processes of the brain, and that's why you have why a brain is necessary, and why it seems that, that consciousness arises in the brain. But from a mystical perspective, this is wrong. So that's the essential difference between the heart doctrine and the head doctrine. The head doctrine says that consciousness is generated magically somehow by the neurochemical processes in the brain, whereas the heart doctrine says that no, consciousness arises in higher dimensional realities, has essentially stepped down and manifests through the heart and illuminates through the heart, which is self-illuminating, and illuminates the processes of the brain. So in a sense, what's being said here is that we are multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe. In other words, we have a physical body, but also we have higher subtle bodies. We have, in the traditional terminology, the astral, the mental, and the causal bodies. And that each of these bodies is a vehicle for higher dimensional capacities of consciousness, so that the consciousness that we experience on the material physical plane, our so-called normal waking consciousness, is really a stepping down of these higher dimensional conscious forces, which are descending and being transformed and stepped down into until they arise and manifest in the physical material plane. Now, I realize that's quite a mouthful can't be readily or quickly digested, but I was going to say diagnosed. Well, it can't be diagnosed either, but it can't be digested. But that's the essential idea, is that we are multidimensional beings and we exist in a multidimensional universe, and that there are higher metaphysical dimensions, and that in order to understand consciousness, we have to understand how human beings are related to these higher dimensional realms, and how we are multidimensional, higher dimensional beings. Like the traditional teachings of mystical and esoteric schools suggest that really in our normal waking consciousness, we're shrouded. We're in a very low level of consciousness, a very low level of light, but that we possess the capacity to transform ourselves and realize ourselves by becoming conscious in our higher being bodies. And by becoming conscious in our higher being bodies, understanding our connection to higher realms of consciousness and being. So, in a sense, the difference between esotericism and modern psychology, I would say, is that modern psychology is attempting to describe human beings as we find them, or as P.D. Uspensky says, as how we imagine we find them. Whereas the esoteric tradition says that in order to know ourselves, in order to understand the full nature of what it means to be human, we have to realize a transformation in our being and our consciousness. We have to undergo what is essentially a psycho-spiritual transformation. We have to awaken to the higher realms of our consciousness and being, and connect with these faculties that we possess, but which in our normal state are dormant. And by awakening these faculties, we can know ourselves as being one with the gods in the universe. And again, this is a rather highfalutin, very complex idea, but that's the nature of the beast that we're dealing with here through this series of programs over the last 3 years. What Christopher and I have been trying to do is to present this model and derived from esoteric and mystical studies of consciousness, to present this model of consciousness and to try to examine it from various angles and to try to explore its depths and try to understand how, by assuming this model, we can come to a very different and very, I think, provocative and more comprehensive understanding of many of the facts of modern science and psychology. Like, what we would suggest and what we've argued in these programs is that essentially what's so important about trying to arrive at this very different model of consciousness is that by doing so, you're led to a more comprehensive understanding of many of the theories and facts of modern science and psychology, one which deals with many of the anomalies and enigmas that exist because of the incompleteness of these ideas. And again, we would suggest that the most glaring a weakness, the major deficiency in modern thought, is its very restricted and fundamentally mistaken notions about the nature of consciousness. So we're arguing that in order to understand consciousness, we have to go beyond this very simplistic and essentially unestablished idea that consciousness is somehow generated magically. And as I say, again, I can't stress this too much, but nobody has ever proved in any way, shape, or form that consciousness is generated by the brain. There's a book out a couple of years ago, Conversations on Consciousness, edited by Susan Blackmore. And the subtitle is, she's a British psychologist. And the subtitle is something, Conversations with What the Greatest Minds in Modern Consciousness Studies Think About the Nature of Consciousness. And first of all, I would dispute that these are the greatest minds on consciousness, but one of them is John Searle, who is a very prominent philosopher who specializes in the subject of consciousness. And at one point, he's talking with Blackmore, and he says, "Well, what we do know beyond doubt is that every one of our conscious experiences is generated by the brain." And he says, "We know it. Every damn one of them is generated by the brain. We know that." He goes on like this. I'm thinking, well, when I was reading this, I'm thinking, first of all, for a guy who's a philosopher, it's a pretty astonishing assertion, because there's no evidence for this. And philosophers are always taught to be very careful about their use of terminology and the assigning of causality to things. And yet Searle says, "Oh, well, there's no doubt. We know this." Well, despite the vigor with which he argues this, we do not know this. He's wrong. He's completely wrong. Now, this is an expert. This is a guy who's supposed to be one of the world's leading minds on the nature of consciousness. But despite that, Mr. Searle is out of his mind, but he's in his mind, but he's wrong. Oh yeah, I found the subtitle is "What the Best Minds Think About the Brain, Free Will, and What It Means to Be Human." Now, given that the book's title is Conversations on Consciousness, it's interesting what the best minds think about the brain. See, there's the assumption is that the brain is somehow the source of consciousness and not only consciousness, but free will and what it means to be human. And that's essentially the thrust of this book. There's conversations with 15 to 20 prominent theorists, and almost without exception, they all endorse this idea that consciousness is being generated by the brain. But again, through this series of programs, what we're trying to do is we're trying to put forward the idea of the heart doctrine and to suggest that that there's a very different, radically different alternative conceptualization of what the nature of consciousness is, what it means to be human, and what free will is, I suppose. I mean, we don't talk in those terms generally about free will, but that's also an implication of the position that we're putting forward. So I wanted to... There's a second aspect to this, too, which is involved in what Christopher Holmes refers to as the zero-point teaching. And this is the label that that he uses for the teaching that he's derived largely from the work of Madame Blavatsky. Madame Blavatsky was the founder of the Theosophical Society in the late 19th century and wrote a number of very erudite, esoteric books, including The Secret Doctrine, which is has been described as the magnum opus of Western esotericism and spirituality. Quite a brilliant book, a difficult book to read. And I think about perhaps 15 to 20 years ago, after he had been studying the various esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness for 12 to 15 years, Chris started to study the Secret Doctrine and Blavatsky's thought. Now, as an aside, Blavatsky's kind of a controversial character. She has been accused at various points of being a charlatan and essentially a con woman and terrible rascal and duping her followers. And from my reading and study of her, I think that to a certain extent that's true. I think that she did dupe people. I think she was a bit of a con woman, and I think she did engage in a variety of dissembling and manipulation of people who were following her. But at the same time, you have to recognize that if you're going to accept that, and I think the evidence is pretty strong, but there are others who would disagree with that characterization and say that it's not. At the same time, you have to recognize that there is no doubt that she was one of the foremost, if not the foremost, scholar of the esoteric and mystical traditions in the late 19th century, and that in The Secret Doctrine and in Isis Unveiled, which were her major works that she wrote, there's been charges that she plagiarized from a variety of sources, including esoteric Tibetan Buddhism and other esoteric Buddhist sources. Despite all that, the fact remains that her books are repositories of quite brilliant thought about the nature of consciousness and reality, and stand as a real challenge to the entire scientific materialist position of which is developed in the 20th century especially. And that was Blavatsky's purpose. What she was saying is that the occult side of human knowledge has never been recognized or approached by modern science, but that eventually that it would have to be. And so when Chris Holmes began to study this material, he said, I remember him telling me that, you know, he found it almost impenetrable at times, but that he persevered and he studied it, and he began to understand what Blavatsky was saying. And one of the most interesting things that he found in her work was, well, partly was the heart doctrine, but it was also the idea that of what he calls the zero points, is that she says that something to the effect that these points, like these zero points, are these points which exist beyond physical differentiation. Like we reach, if we try to measure something and we go to lower and smaller levels of physical manifestation, we reach a point where we can't measure anymore. It's something becomes so infinitesimally small that we can't measure it. And Blavatsky says that these zero points are the points through which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. And what she's saying, what she's asserting essentially, is that these points are rooted into higher dimensional realities, higher dimensional planes. And from these planes, various levels of intelligence and being manifest in various ways on the physical plane. So that she says any sun, which by which she means any entity, any organism, any world, is a manifestation out of these zero points. So in a sense, she's saying that everything in material physical creation is somehow rooted into these to zero points, into these, is a manifestation of these zero points, through these zero points. And so in a sense, you could think of zero points as being portals through which higher dimensional realities manifest in the physical, observable, material plane in which we move and live and have our being. And what Christopher Holmes developed from this was the idea that at the heart of a human being, like if you consider a human being electromagnetically, the electromagnetic field in the heart is 5,000 times that which is generated by the brain. So in an electromagnetic sense, the center of a human being is not in their brain, it's in their heart. And what Chris is saying is that if you read the mystical and esoteric literature, over and over again you find this description of this infinitesimal point, which is located in the heart, and it, which is said to be the source of life and consciousness. Life and consciousness are said to have been generated from this point, and that this point is rooted into higher dimensional realities. Now, that's exactly what Blavatsky is suggesting. And she's suggesting that this applies to all of creation. Well, interestingly, The Secret Doctrine, I believe, was published in 1888. And in that, what Blavatsky describes is that the universe was created out of a nothingness. An essential nothingness, which was both a void and a plenum. Like, that's the paradox, is that there was a nothingness which was full. And out of this point source, the universe emerged, and it emerged through the processes of symmetry breaking and, according to certain, metaphysical laws of creation. Now, what's really interesting about that is that that's entirely consistent with modern cosmological ideas. Is that, you know, at the beginning of time we had the Big Bang, which was a singularity condition, which is what currently physicists and cosmologists assert is that the origins of the universe, everything was concentrated into this super dense singularity condition, this point. And from this point source, you had the generation of the physical universe. So you had symmetry breaking, which is exactly what Madame Blavatsky describes, and you have this manifestation of the physical universe out of this super concentrated point. Well, she says that as human beings, we similarly embody the same principle, that we emerged out of a concentrated point, the singularity, which is rooted into the higher dimensions of reality, and that this point is centered in the heart. And this is the essential nature of Chris's integration of the heart doctrine and the zero point teaching. Now, in order to get a better grasp of what this involves, I'm just sort of giving a thumbnail sketch of this. But I would, if you're interested, I would urge people to go to Chris's website, and that's at www.zeropoint.ca. And on the site, Chris has a number of postings related to the articulation of the heart doctrine, as well as the zero point teaching. And he has a variety of interesting quotes on there, involving a lot of different things, from mystical and esoteric teachings about the heart doctrine. Some wonderful, I was just reviewing the site today, some wonderful material, and also the explanations of Blavatsky's teachings. He has little excerpts from his writings that are really kind of give a nice primer on an overview of what he's saying in his books. I'm not sure, because he keeps changing them around, but at the last count, I think Chris had 7 books, and all of his books are described on his website, and you can go there and you can look at them. I think the 2 of them deal with the Gurdjieff and Uspensky fourth way teaching, which was, for both Chris and I, that was our introduction to mystical and esoteric teachings. And he has 3 books, which largely deal with the ideas of Blavatsky and articulation and elaboration of the teachings of the secret doctrine and how those ideas relate to both modern psychology, esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness, and cosmology and modern physics. And I'm rather prejudiced on this level, but I would say I don't know of anyone writing today who studies consciousness and who tries to deal with the quote-unquote big issues relating to consciousness and the nature of reality that has integrated so successfully both the mystical and esoteric perspectives and modern psychology, physics, and other sciences. Chris's concentration tends to be on physics and cosmology, less so on biology, but definitely he has interest in those issues too. I don't know of anyone who does such an interesting and I think comprehensive job of relating these ancient ideas to modern ideas in science and psychology, and has really developed a model which, if nothing else, is a very useful device for examining a lot of our basic assumptions that we subscribe to in modern thought about the nature of ourselves, about the nature of consciousness, about the nature of reality, and about the nature and of the origins of the universe and the purpose of the universe. These are pretty big questions, and he certainly puts forward a perspective which brings these things into focus in a, I would say, a radically different fashion from that which most people, even those who know of esoteric teachings, are able to articulate. I'd say that the heart doctrine and its integration within the zero point teachings and its explication in terms of the zero point dynamics is a very different perspective from that which any other writer has formulated that I know of. And I think there are certain people whose writings and whose theories are consistent with Chris's, or who in some ways share certain points of reference and emphasis, but I think that his perspective is quite radically different from anyone else's. And so I would urge you to go to www.zeropoint.ca and check this out and see what you can find there. If there's anything interesting to you, I think that, as I say, I think that it's difficult to grasp without considerable effort and time the implications of what's being said, and to really begin to understand it. It's like it's just not something that you can easily digest. I don't say that to scare people off, but just to caution them that you have to work with these ideas. That I think that's the experience that Chris and I, over the past 32 years since we began to study esoteric and mystical ideas, have come to the conclusion that when you study this material, even if you're sympathetic to it, even if you're attracted to it, even if you immediately sense that you are hearing important truth, no matter how much you think you understand it, you don't, because you're just beginning to grasp the rudiments of an entirely different way of thinking about things. Everything you've been taught in school, everything that you've been told is true, everything that you've assumed is true, is in some fundamental way wrong. Or Gurdjieff says in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson that the human beings, those that he refers to as the three brain beings of the planet Earth, have an ingrained capacity to see everything upside down or topsy-turvy. And that's the kind of disorienting experience you have as you begin to grasp what the esoteric and mystical conceptualizations of the nature of consciousness and reality are. That's the disorienting sensation you have, as you realize, oh my God, everything I've been taught is somehow fundamentally wrong, or is completely misoriented, or and leads to disorientation rather than bringing us closer to reality. It's reinforcing the illusions that are common to the normal waking state of consciousness, both about ourselves and the nature of the universe and pretty much everything in between. But the great fun of it all is that as you begin to study these things, this is my own personal experience and something I think Chris would endorse, is that it's fascinating to have all of your beliefs about things challenged and to begin to come to a completely different understanding. I would say the last 10 to 15 years that as Chris and I have continued to work at this, I've become, I used to be inclined to be very cautious about asserting, you know, that I thought I understood anything because I realized I really didn't understand anything. But I'm beginning to become much, much more vocal and about what I understand about these things while admitting my ignorance about most things. But I've become a little bit more assertive, I think, in suggesting that I really do believe that at the very least the esoteric conceptualization of consciousness is much closer to the truth, quote-unquote, than anything that modern psychology or modern science even remotely suggests. I think that a real study of consciousness, a comprehensive study of consciousness, has to include the mystical and esoteric tradition. I don't understand how anyone could profess to study consciousness without immersing themselves in various mystical and esoteric teachings and trying to grasp what they say, because they are so profound and so important, so significant. And at the same time, has to be familiar with modern scientific ideas, because modern science touches on a variety of issues and has a variety of tools that just aren't available to, weren't available in the past and still aren't available to those who study themselves through an esoteric or mystical teaching. But that's the impetus for all this, is to try to, for everything that Chris and I are trying to do, is to try to bring these ancient esoteric and mystical ideas together with modern science and psychology to develop a more comprehensive and a more accurate model of the nature of consciousness and reality. And when I say it, it sounds incredibly preposterous and pompous and self-important. But I guess what sort of limits that for me is that I realize, like, these aren't the ideas that we developed. We didn't sit around and think these things up. This is the product of thousands of years of human inquiry, and all we've done is we've studied these things and we've tried to understand them without prejudice, and what we've come to is a completely different understanding of things. And that's what Chris has articulated in his books, that's what I've written about in my books, is that once you begin to understand these things, you just see, like, what a profound history there is in the study of consciousness, and that modern sciences and especially modern psychology is completely out to lunch in its dismissal of these ideas, and it's acquired ignorance and suppression of these materials. That how anybody can get a PhD in psychology without having studied Gurdjieff and Uspensky and the Sufis and the Vedas and the Kabbalah and esoteric Buddhism and the teachings of the Heart Master Adi Da and Rama Maharshi and Maharishi and a variety of other teachings. I mean, that's just the surface. How anybody could ever get a PhD in psychology without studying this material is beyond me. It's ludicrous. And for that reason alone, I think that this is one of the compelling reasons to recognize the importance of what Dr. Christopher Holmes has done in his work over the past 30 years. I'm a friend of Chris's, but I'm also a real admirer of his work intellectually. If I didn't know him, I would admire his work tremendously. The fact that I've had anything to do with it is both a pleasure and a privilege, but it's also incidental to what he says. I mean, whether or not I had anything to do with it or studied it is almost incidental in the sense of its significance. It's there to be read, it's there to be studied, and as I say, even if I didn't know him, I'd be knocked out by his work, and so it's been that much more fun over the past 30 years to have studied this material together and tried to understand it, and so that's what we've been doing. I guess try to create a little bit of a segue. At when we come up to the hour, we're going to have a brief break, and we're going to come back with Mark from Ottawa, who's going to talk a little bit about the presentation of Dr. Griffin in Ottawa last week, and talk a bit about the 9/11 movement, 9/11 truth movement in Ottawa, and hopefully other places, and we'll touch on a variety of issues having to do with that. But I, in order to sort of put this in some perspective, I just wanted to say a few words about how what's happened sort of in the last few years with Christopher's understanding of this and my own understanding of the whole 9/11 phenomenon, and how we've come to be skeptics and disbelievers in the official story, and how in Chris's case he's become a very forceful and even strident critic of the official story, and challenger of assorted conventional wisdom regarding politics and the world situation. As they say, I've known Christopher since I guess over 40 years now, 41 years. We were in high school together in Ottawa, and he used to date my neighbor, whom he eventually married, so we sort of had tangential contact through school. But it was in 1968 when we both began to attend Carleton University in Ottawa, and Chris was studying psychology, I was studying sociology, that we became very close friends, and we became sort of intellectual compatriots, and started to study a variety of topics that interested us, and we were always discussing these things. And Chris was very interested in psychology. He knew when he was a teenager that he was going to be a psychologist. That's what he was going to do with his life, and he had a real interest in existential philosophy while he was in university as an undergraduate, and sort of introduced me to some of that. And he and I were both very interested in hypnosis, and we're interested in psychedelic drugs and their effects on consciousness, both theoretically and experientially. And we had a variety of interests in common, and New Left studies. And at the time, we were both vigorous opponents of the war in Vietnam. But I was clearly the more political of the two of us. Chris was somewhat involved, but not terribly, and really his focus of his study was on psychology, and that's what he was really interested in, that's what he wanted to be. And he went off to do his doctorate, and after I completed my education, my undergraduate, I left school and worked for a few years, and then decided that what I really wanted to do was go back to school and get my PhD in psychology. So I went back and took a year of psychology, and then entered the master's program in 1976 and or 75, and at Carleton University in Ottawa. And by this point, Christopher was starting to work on his dissertation at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. And Chris had a really nice career going. He was had already been recognized for some of the papers he'd written on personality theory by his teachers and by other professors who had been introduced to some of his work. And he could have been a very successful clinical psychologist, academic psychologist, lecturer. He had a nice career going. And then, fatefully, he read In Search of the Miraculous by P.D. Uspensky about G.I. Gurdjieff and his fourth way teaching. And that was his introduction to mystical and esoteric teachings, and with that, his entire life changed. So, as a result of being introduced to Gurdjieff's ideas, Chris became very interested in his understanding of the nature of consciousness, and he managed to translate Gurdjieff's ideas on consciousness, like the most fundamental idea being is that Gurdjieff says that in our normal waking consciousness, what we call waking consciousness, we are in fact asleep, that we exist in a waking sleep, what he calls a waking sleep, and that we exist in a state of semi-hypnotic associative existence where everything happens. That's something Gurdjieff says, that we don't do anything, everything happens. And that as a result, human beings aren't aware of the psychological illusions under which they live and breathe and have their being, and they don't realize that all the things they attribute to themselves, like an indivisible and continuous I, the capacity to do, and to be self-conscious whenever or wherever they want, are completely illusory. And so these fundamental ideas Chris took and started developing and was able to operationalize and apply to the psychotherapy situation. And so he did his dissertation on Gurdjieff's theory of consciousness as it pertained to the psychotherapy situation. And in that process, he introduced me to his Gurdjieff's teaching, and through his dissertation, which I continually kept reading, he kept giving me updated copies, and we started studying it together. And I realized right away, well, this is the truth. This is something utterly profound and really opened my eyes to all sorts of issues in psychology, which I had never fully understood before. And I just thought this is amazing. So I started doing my master's thesis along the same lines, but I also served as Chris's I served as his research advisor, and together he developed a taxonomy to categorize psychotherapeutic communication, and he and I listened to psychotherapy tapes, and we analyzed them, and we coded them and classified them, and that was the data for which he presented in his dissertation. And I developed the ideas that he had applied to the psychotherapy situation, and they extended them to other types of interviews for my master's thesis. And as a result of that, as I say, Chris became introduced to the fourth way teaching, and he and I studied the fourth way very extensively for 4 or 5 years and just really became immersed in studying it and really developed a profound sense of this whole different type of psychological teaching, which was represented in this esoteric teaching, and how the division between psychology and cosmology was completely arbitrary, that really in order to study psychology, you actually had to study cosmology. Now, the connections there are very, it's very complicated and somewhat abstruse, but this leads to the ideas that he's developed later as how really in order to study the psychology of consciousness, we have to study ourselves as we relate to the entire cosmos, and that's which is what he has done through his development of the heart doctrine and the zero point teaching. But as a result of this, as I say, Chris started stepping outside of the mainstream, and he got a job at York University in Toronto in the late 70s, I guess, and began teaching there. And he taught a variety of courses on psychology of consciousness, was very popular with his students, worked as a counselor at the university also. And when his tenure came up, he was denied tenure, and then he engaged in a very long fight and eventually decided to leave the university because he realized that they weren't going to give him his tenure. Now, he had written an entire book about the fourth way teaching, and he'd begun work on another book about the relationship of the psychology of consciousness to issues of spirituality and religion in modern society, which was entitled The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. Very, very interesting work. And yet, because he hadn't murdered any rats or duped any undergraduates in a real psychological experiment, he lost his job. And so he went along, and he eventually was hired. He was unemployed for a few years, and he eventually secured a position as a forensic psychologist, and he worked in two correctional facilities in Ontario. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, he left his job at the correctional facility to work full-time at his writing and develop his model of consciousness. Don, I'm just going to tell you that I want to extend this a few minutes. I want to go over the 5 o'clock because I just want to complete these thoughts. So don't interrupt me as we agreed at 5 o'clock. We'll wait and take a break. I'll give you the signal when we need to stop. So during this process, as I say, Chris really became, after studying Gurdjieff-Uspensky material, started to study other esoteric teachings and became more and more informed about different teachings. He's very interested in the Vedas and studied the Vedas. And very interested in Sufism and esoteric Christianity, but then he really became interested in theosophy and Madame Blavatsky's teachings about 15, 20 years ago and really started to develop them, and then became very interested in the heart teachings of Heart Master Adi Da, contemporary teacher, and also in Kabbalah. And so he really broadened his entire perspective on the mystical and esoteric tradition. And through all of this, like, knowing Christopher, as I say, for more than 40 years, this guy lived and breathed this material. He is, in some ways, the typical absent-minded professor. He's not a very conscious person in some ways. He's completely immersed in his theoretical musings and developing material. And in some ways, he's one of the most conscious people I know. In some ways, he's one of the most unconscious people I know. And that's just, he has a very distinct personality. And as I say, this guy lived and breathed his work. And everything else could be going on. And he had some interest in it, but not a terrible amount. So I was quite shocked when a couple of years ago, he had visited New York and come back from New York, and his youngest son had asked him, he had visited the site of Ground Zero in New York, and his son had asked him if he had seen the movie Loose Change, and so he watched the internet movie Loose Change and was quite shocked by the representation put forth in the movie about how there was this grand deception in uncovering what had actually happened in 9/11 and how the whole official story was just so much BS. It was just meant to validate and to encourage the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how it's a complete fabrication and fraud. And so he started to really become involved in this, which, as I say, from my perspective, I found very, very shocking and surprising, because, like, over all the time we've known one another, like I said, Chris has never been a particularly political person or a person who even pays that much attention to what's going on in the world. In the late 70s, he'd been involved in the anti-nuclear movement to a certain extent, and definitely was paying attention to that. But that was about the only time that I'd ever seen him really politically involved. So I was quite shocked when he all of a sudden developed this interest in 9/11 and started to really question things. And as a result of that, for the last couple of years on our program, we've dealt with a lot of issues relating to 9/11 and also to the world situation, and have discussed numerous matters pertaining to this, which is really outside of the scope of what the program began to be about, which was originally, as I say, it was an examination of esoteric, mystical conceptualizations of consciousness and their implications for the study of science and psychology and for our understanding of ourselves and the universe. And, you know, that should be enough for anybody. But, as I say, now we've been, paying more and more attention and especially to the, all of the fallout from 9/11 and, the huge conspiracy that exists in terms of the government's misrepresentation as to what happened on that date, and everything that's followed from it, from going to war to the suppression of liberties to the invasion of privacy that's happened in the United States, as well as almost every other Western democracy. Here in Canada, we've had not the fallout to the extent that, of course, has happened in the United States, but certainly we're part of the club. We've had our liberties infringed, and we're in Afghanistan. There were three Canadian soldiers killed the other day in Afghanistan. We've been part of the forces occupying Afghanistan since that ill-advised and I think unjustifiable incursion into Afghanistan, and we stayed out of Iraq miraculously, but we're part of the party, as are all of the other Western democracies. They're all implicated, and they're all part of the cover up. I mean, nobody questions the official version of things, except in Canada for the Canadian Action Party and a few brave voices in the States. But when I referred to those websites earlier, if you go to Patriot question911.com, I was, even knowing that there's a considerable movement in the United States of people who question the truth of 9/11, I was shocked by the roll call of distinguished and important people who question the official version of things. And again, I would urge people to go to that website and investigate. I think if you are in any way skeptical about the criticisms of 9/11, you'll be you'll have your eyes opened by who's on that website. So that's just a bit of background. As I say, we're gonna have a guest on from Ottawa. Don, I don't know if you want to take a brief break here. I could use a moment to take a drink of water and.
Houston, we have a problem.
State your problem.
Picking up transmission from Mars.
Hey everybody, this is your new friend, Julio, and I'm talking to you because I like to listen to BBSRadio.com. I sneak over the border every day, and I go see my girlfriend. She got a computer. Come on now, sing it, girls.
Sitting in for Christopher Holmes. Well, I actually generally do sit in with Christopher Holmes, but Christopher is at the Canadian Action Party Convention in Ottawa in Canada this week and has asked me to conduct the festivities here. And as I mentioned in the last hour, at the beginning of the last hour, I had the pleasure and privilege last Thursday of going to Ottawa from Toronto to hear Dr. David Ray Griffin speak on 9/11. Dr. Griffin is the author of several publications, several very good books on 9/11 and the official cover-up and questioning various aspects of it. And he gave a really wonderful presentation, very succinct, very measured, very compelling, questioning the official, almost every essential element of the official version of things. Really raising a number of very, very disturbing and provocative questions as to what actually happened on 9/11 and how everything that's happened as a consequence of the supposed events of 9/11 has fallen from these really reprehensible and immoral, illegal, and name any other adjective you want, reprehensible conduct of certain elements of the American government. And as I say, David Ray Griffin has a variety of publications. His first book, which was called The New Pearl Harbor, there's an updated version out, and I would highly recommend that you look into seeing if you can obtain a copy and read it, because it's a very, very important book. As promised earlier, we have a guest, Mark from Ottawa. Mark is involved in the 9/11 First Truth movement and was also at the. Did you actually organize the presentation by Dr. Griffin?
No, I had nothing to do with it. It was organized by the Ottawa Vanier Canadian Action Party Association,
okay,
which was recently formed in Ottawa, recently being 2-3 months ago.
Okay.
And they did the David Ray Griffin event for the run-up to the convention, which they're having, because Connie Fogel was also in attendance Thursday night at the lecture. Connie Fogel being the leader of the Canadian Action Party. She was in attendance at the event. There was Diana Ralph was in attendance. She was she wrote a thing called Islamophobia and the War on Terrorism.
Oh, okay.
So she's a professor, I think, at Carleton University.
Oh.
And so she was in, so there were many actual people who have written on the subject of 9/11 truth in attendance. The turnout was, there were 200 seats, and I'd say it was easily 80 to 90% full. There were not many seats that were empty, which was great, because we didn't know how much of the turnout was going to happen. I was involved in so much as I knew the people who were involved, and, you know, they'd talk to me. I talked to them a few times, helped them out just with different things like postering and stuff.
Right.
But for the most part, that's how the only advertising we really did was a couple of website links. And posters on telephone poles, and so no, I was not. I had nothing to do with organizing David Ray Griffin coming in. But the good news is, they did invite me to have dinner with them the night before. So Wednesday night, I had the pleasure of having dinner for a 2-hour dinner with David Ray Griffin. So
very good.
I got to ask him a lot of questions. I was pretty excited.
yeah, very interesting. Well, I guess one of the small pieces of publicity got me there was that we had Michael St. Ange was on Zero Point Radio about 6 weeks ago, I believe, and and he mentioned that Dr. Griffin was coming to Ottawa, which really excited me, because you know, I've been following his lectures, and as I when we spoke earlier today, I told you I was an admirer of Dr. Griffin's work on philosophy and theology. I've read a couple of his books and was really impressed by his work. He's very erudite, very insightful guy who has a wide variety of interests, and his work is actually quite consistent with the work that Christopher and I have been doing for the last 30 years, although I think he doesn't really incorporate the mystical aspects into it, so into what he says. But as I told you, I was kind of surprised. I remember a few years ago coming across this reference to the new Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin. I'm thinking, wow, David Ray Griffin, it can't be two. It's got to be the same guy that you know, is a theologian and philosopher. And I was, at the time, I was a little shocked that, you know, such a prominent academic and would be speaking out about 9/11 and, you know, questioning the official version. And, of course, as I said the other night, I asked Dr. Griffin what effect this has had on his career, and he replied that I sounded like his wife.
Did my wife talk to you? Yeah.
Because I think he's pretty much put his career on hold to investigate this, which increases my admiration for him that much more. Would you like to talk a little bit about what he said, or
from what I recall, it was a 2-hour talk. I believe that the topic title was something to the effect of, were Muslim hijackers, were they on the plane?
Yeah.
And then he proceeded to ask 16 questions, or pose 16 questions, like, what's the evidence, where did we hear about this, how do we know this happened, and then he goes through and shows the evidence, and a lot of it is detained from single snippets of information that came out somewhere wasn't sourced, torture. There was a lot of evidence that was gleaned from torture, and the people weren't even allowed to witness because it was videotaped.
Right.
They weren't even allowed to witness the interrogations. They had to go with transcripts which were provided from the CIA or whoever, to them. This is to the 9/11 Commission. And so he really covered a lot of interesting areas, and it was a really well done talk. And he has a certain way about him too, which is fantastic. You don't mind listening to him, he doesn't get dry, doesn't get boring. He's very animated, we'll say. if that's the proper term. I don't know.
Yeah, when I was speaking to you earlier, I was impressed by the new Pearl Harbor. It's very concise, it's quite elegant, and the measured tone that of the whole book is at least saying, look, I don't know what happened, but I have the following questions about the official version as to what happened. And the other night, even though I've now read tons of material questioning the official version, what struck me in the earlier part of his presentation is really so many of the assumptions we have about what happened are really based on the most flimsy and really insubstantial evidence. It's surprisingly thin. That was a phrase that I think Noam Chomsky at one point said, although Noam believes the official story. But I guess that I was really impressed by the way he essentially shredded almost every essential element of the official version. The evidence just is not there that even Osama bin Laden's involvement is paper thin, really. There's a videotape where he says he did it. Yeah, but there's an earlier videotape where he says he doesn't. And the
and
second
the videotape
one is
that says he did came out of occupied Iraq 2 years after, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not very credible.
Yeah.
He did say that. He said his sort of angle that he was taking was, I don't know what happened, but I know for a fact that the official version cannot be true. And then he points all that out, and it's an interesting angle, but it works, you know. And it was well done. That was done by Mike St. Ange of the Canadian Action Party, as well as the whole association that's been formed here. It's made up of many 9/11 truthers that do come out every 11th on the 11th of every month.
Right.
We've been doing that since April of 2007, going out on the 11th of every month and handing out free DVDs in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And so I was really impressed with the turnout at that David Ray Griffin lecture, because we didn't know. Like, there's maybe 30 of us that go out to these actions.
Right.
But there were 200 seats, right?
Yeah.
Once the night started, there was no fear that it was going to be empty. It was a packed place. So.
What is the reaction when you go out and hand out that material? What kind of response do you get from people?
Good. We get a lot of people. At first, it was people just had no clue who we were. Now it's keep the good work. I appreciate you guys being out here. We have every now and then a negative comment, but not too often. Nobody's actually come walking up and started yelling at us or anything.
Uh-huh.
Most people are just, you know, they either take the information or they don't. So some people walk by, scowl, you know, don't say anything, but
yeah,
that's fine. They might do that to everybody who tries to hand them something, you know, on the street. So.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah, so,
I guess.
No, the response has been positive.
I guess one of the things that I find, there are a variety of things I find very disturbing about all this, but one of the things I find disturbing and somewhat puzzling, although I understand it on a certain level, is that in David Ray Griffin's book, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, at the beginning, and I've seen this from other sources too, he cites the various polls that have been conducted. And something like, I think in about 2005, 2004, something like 53% of New Yorkers,
yep,
stated that they didn't believe the official version of the 9/11 Commission report was telling the truth as to what had happened. And you get the same kind of figures in Canada, in Western Europe. There's widespread public disbelief in the official version, and yet there's absolutely no parallel representation of any kind of skepticism in any of the mainstream media publications, or any kind of indication in the mainstream media that there's this widespread disbelief. I find that very peculiar.
It's a total disconnect, and it is shocking, because when you delve into this stuff, there's mountains and mountains and mountains of research. I mean,
yeah,
people all across the spectrum are coming out with the information and with videos and with movies, and it's really come a long way. But then you walk down the street and you talk to five people, and maybe one of them knows what you're talking about. The other four will look at you like you just, you know, like they've never heard this. They have no clue what it is you're talking about, or as if that would happen, you know. So there is definitely a block, and but a lot more people know now, and the thing is, it's getting hard. the way I look at it is, once you, I don't really care if you believe or you don't believe that the official story or the conspiracy theories about 9/11, but at least be aware that they're out there. You know, that that information exists, because for all the people that you'll meet in a given day, maybe 2 to 5 know. You know, so that number has to be up to, you know, higher. It has to be, it has to become common household words, you know, like false flag terrorism, all of it. It has to be exposed. So, but we've been doing quite a bit in Ottawa, in the last year. I know tomorrow or they're planning, maybe even tonight, if the weather holds out, they're planning to go to, the X. And hand out flyers and information to people coming in and out of the X.
So,
yeah, and that's not me. That's that's other members of the 9/11 Truth Movement. I think in Ottawa. I mean, I think what's happened is because there's so many people who, you know, sit back and don't do anything, or oh, what are you going to do? It doesn't matter. I can't do that because I have to watch American Idol. You know,
right? Yeah,
and things like that. Those people will say, in one in out of 30 people, maybe one is a leader. I think what's happened in Ottawa is all the people who have stepped up are leaders.
Right.
So it's really become organic, where everybody is doing stuff. They organized that thing to go down to the X and hand out flyers. They're going to film it. They're going to make a YouTube clip probably. I had nothing to do with that, you know.
Yeah.
Getting David Ray Griffin here, I don't know the roots of the story, but I'm assuming, I know that once it came up, a lot of the people on that team are 9/11 truthers, so they were all over it, you know.
Right.
So, and that wasn't happening in 2006. There was nothing going on in Ottawa. And now there's the march coming up. On September 11th, there's going to be people coming from Vancouver to Halifax. They're all merging on Parliament Hill at noon on September 11th. And they plan on staying there until the 15th when Parliament opens.
Really?
So, yeah.
Until the 15th. Wow.
Yeah, there's people physically marching from Montreal on September 7th. They're starting marching, 150 plus people, and they're going to march all the way up to Ottawa.
Wow. It'll be interesting to see how the media is able to avoid reporting on that, eh?
It will be interesting, considering that we've already spoken with the police, the town police, the Montreal police. We've got the parade route all wrecking. It's going to be cordoned off, so we're going to have the whole thing, you know, the streets will be closed, so it's not an issue. It's a sanctioned march.
Wow.
And it's going right to Parliament. There's people coming in from all across the world. There's leaders from all the different 9/11 truth groups in Canada, and there are many. There's at least, I'd say, 10 to 15 cities in Canada now have functioning 9/11 truth groups that are doing stuff almost every month.
Wow.
So it's really just in Canada alone. The States, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
So We Are Change Colorado has over 150 members. That's insane, you know?
Yeah.
Ottawa has over 30 members. We have 30 to 50, I would say, easily, and people that show up every month, you know? And not every month they won't show up, but, I mean, in a given month, it's always between 16 and 30, but it's from a pool of about 50 people, so you don't see the same people coming out every month.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because everybody has their own take on it, and everybody does their own thing. It's great. It works out really well. But we gather and we hand out discs. 300 DVDs a month go out, and we were doing this just in Ottawa, but this march on Ottawa was coordinated by the guys in Montreal on Ottawa 9/11, or sorry, Montreal 9/11 Truth. They orchestrated the march, so it coincides with, because we do it the 11th of every month, September 11th, so we're not actually having a truth action here in Ottawa. The country is coming to Ottawa, and we're just going to be a part of that, so it's fantastic. I can't wait. We've got live bands lined up from some of the local bands have come out. They're bringing bands from Vancouver. There's a bus that's driving from Vancouver to Montreal, and they're stopping all along the way and handing out 9/11 supply like stuff. Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Thunder Bay. They're crossing the whole country, and they're making scheduled stops, you know.
Sure.
And then they get to Montreal, then they physically march with the rest of them to Ottawa. So,
yeah. For our listeners, it's about 120 miles from Montreal to Ottawa. So that's a good hike. And
yeah. 4 days, September 7th to September 11th, they're doing it.
Wow.
And all the information for that can be found on MarchOnOttawa2008.org. and you can they have everything, the schedule, the itinerary, you can register. If you're in a city along that way, you can start a rally and greet them when they arrive.
Oh, yeah.
They call it the Truth Bus, and it's like a school bus, but it's been repainted with 9/11 Truth stuff on it.
Okay.
And they've got, I don't know, they got a lot of discs they're going to be handing out. So.
Yeah. Sorry, it was March on Ottawa 2008.ca
or .org.
.org.
Yeah, ORG. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So people should check that out, especially in Ontario and Western Quebec, March on Ottawa 2008.org, or if you want to come from wherever, upstate New York, Vermont, Maine, you know, anywhere.
Yeah, people coming. And actually, they had an app on the website where you could say, I live in this town, I am coming, and it would put a little pin, you know.
Oh!
And the count was up there, and then it got erased when nobody knows how it got erased. But
isn't that
got all wiped out, you know?
So, oh, I'm sure that was just a coincidence.
Oh, probably, you know. but it did happen. So,
oh, yeah. Well,
so we really don't know how many people are coming. I know there's 150-plus marchers.
Uh-huh.
I know we've done our best to get the word out about this march in the Ottawa area. We're telling everybody.
Yeah.
And handing out brochures, posters on telephone poles. We've really done our best to get the word out. And so what we're hoping for is a cross-Canada convergence.
Yeah.
That's huge. And Nathan Moulton from Calgary 9/11 Truth is flying in. He's going to be in attendance. He's actually speaking on the Hill. I don't know, they call him the Walmart Truther. He was in Truth Rising, the new movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's the guy who got on the Walmart intercom and started saying 9/11 was an inside job. So in Calgary.
I didn't know that.
No, it's on, just type Walmart 9/11 into YouTube and you'll see him. He's he's the main guy in, or the front man, I guess you'd call him, for the Calgary 9/11 Truth.org.
Oh, okay.
And so,
and sorry, what was his last name again, Nathan?
Moulton.
Moulton.
Moulton. Yeah.
Okay.
But he's coming into Ottawa all the way from Calgary to attend this march. So there are definitely people coming.
yeah. That's quite exciting. Mm-hmm.
They've also presented a petition to Parliament. And the petition is supposed to be read on September 15th. It's been read into the record already. Libby Davies from BC already read it in.
Oh.
NDP. They're actually picking up the petition, supposedly, and talking about it on the first day of session, when Parliament resumes.
Right.
So that's why, and the people were already staying until the 15th anyway, so that's great, you know. So
yeah.
They had wanted to stay till the 15th, so I mean, it does coincide. So we've actually got, there's a petition in Parliament demanding a new investigation, and it's been signed. You can find the link to the petition on the March on Ottawa 2008 website.
Okay.
And I recommend, everybody has to sign that. There's over 2,000 signatures now. There was 1,500 or 1,000 when it got read in. So it's, I mean, the more the merrier, you know?
Yeah.
Step up. If that's all you're going to do, at least put your name on that petition.
Sign the petition. And what does the petition say?
It's demanding that we pull out of, or we're demanding an investigation into 9/11. I don't have it in front of me, but it's something about, there's 3 points in there, and I think one of them is that we investigate and rethink our role in Afghanistan, because our role in Afghanistan is based off of, I think it was NATO declared war on Afghanistan for harboring Osama bin Laden, who was wanted for 9/11.
Right.
Well, now Osama bin Laden's not wanted for 9/11, according to the FBI.
Yeah.
Maybe we should rethink why we're there. We're losing soldiers. How many did we lose last week? I know there were 3 that got killed on one day.
Yeah, there were three on one day, but like everybody else, you know, it's like I pay attention to the bigger headlines, but you don't even hear sometimes. Well, I mean, they're all reported in Canada. I'll say they are reported, but you kind of lose track after a while, and you begin to expect that. That's the worst part.
Yeah, you get fatigue almost.
Which
is a sad thing to think about someone's life, you know.
I mean, you know, these people go over there with the very best of intentions, I think, and misrepresented by their government and sold down the river, essentially, they're overdoing what they're trained to do, you know, to give your life for something like this, because, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney want cheaper oil is really disturbing, to say the least.
It has to do with the offensive war versus the defensive war, and the defense of your country is one thing when you're being invaded by a foreign foe. But it's a totally different thing when you're the aggressor, you're the occupier, you're the, you know. And Afghanistan, the problem that I have with that is that they're using the depleted uranium rounds, and it's a nuclear wasteland now.
Yeah.
And people are getting sick, those mutations and those childbirths and cancers. And it's going to be there for billions of, or what, half a billion years or something?
Yeah.
And that's terrible. It's that's nuclear war, you know?
Yeah.
And now they're even threatening nuclear war on the grand scale. Russia responded, said that they would use their nukes on Poland, you know?
Yeah.
That's getting pretty scary. We don't have mutual assured destruction protecting everybody, you know?
I mean, well, from my reading, I think the likelihood of either Pakistan or India exploding at least an atomic bomb on one another is pretty high, because over the, you know, the dispute over Kashmir too. It's just, it all adds to the instability. But as Chris and I have talked about, the, you know, depleted uranium in Iraq, we already have it in effect, and not on the level of an atomic bomb, but certainly it's
slow
poisoning. Killing and poisoning people and creating untold misery, you know. I mean, for both Iraqis and for Americans, it's an equal opportunity killer, I guess.
Yeah, and it gets stirred up every time the wind blows.
And then blows God knows where.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People inhale it. That's a major problem, and I don't understand how they got away with that. That's to me, that's horrid, horrific.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very disturbing. I just went on that site, and I see that they have the actual YouTube of Libby Davies reading the petition. And cool.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Stockwell Day has responded somewhat. That was posted on 9/11 Blogger. A few days ago.
What does Stockwell have to say?
Something to the effect of, we don't feel we need to investigate it. Canada's assured that nothing would be untoward or something. It wasn't written very, it was just shortened to the point, you know.
Well, Stockwell's an idiot anyway, so, you know.
Not to be
judgmental, but he's a moron, so I mean, I'm not
completely... Well, he was in attendance at the Montebello Summit.
Yeah.
So everybody saw the picture of him chasing George Bush on a bicycle, you know, that was on the cover of all our papers. So he was in attendance. He's also the guy who was doing the security for that event, or in charge of security, and then all those unions said they wanted an investigation into the provocateur situation in Montebello, and he said no. He said, we're not doing it. And he actually blamed the protesters. He said, well, the reason they got caught was because they weren't being violent, and that signaled them out or something. And if you watch the video, that's not what was happening. So it was... And so I didn't expect, when I heard Stockwell Day was taking care of this petition, I did not expect a positive answer anyway.
Yeah, just not terribly reassuring, is it?
Yeah, exactly. So
I just pause here for a second, Mark, and just let people know that if you want to talk to Mark or me or to both of us, you can call in the U.S. It's the number is 1-877-876-5227, or in Canada it's 1-888-815-9756, or you can reach BBS at their direct line by calling 1-530-876-3222. Don, I hope those numbers are up to date. That's my old copy. But, yeah, if anybody wants to call in and has a comment or a question, we'd certainly welcome it. I have in my notes here, Mark, that you asked me to ask you about Richard Gage. So I'll ask you about Richard Gage because I don't know what that refers to.
Well, because of the success of the David Ray Griffin event, this isn't through CAP or anything, but the idea has been floated that we're going to start contacting others and try to organize other talks at the Ottawa Public Library.
Right.
Because you were at the event. It was packed. There are people who want to know this stuff. The people in Ottawa know who these people are. And Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is, he's very important. You know, he's doing the analysis and the rebuttal for the NIST report, which has come out. He just demanded all the documents and calculations, all the knowledge that they collected to come to their conclusions that have you heard about the NIST report that came out Tuesday?
You just mentioned it. NIST is National
yeah.
Institute for Safety. Is that
yeah? National Institute of Standards
oh.
and Technology.
Yeah.
They just issued a report on why Building 7 fell, and their conclusion was, if I can remember correctly, it was a unique phenomenon known as thermal expansion caused normal office fires caused one particular beam in the building to overheat, and this caused a cascade, and then everything inside fell apart, but the outside stayed out so everybody could see it. And then what we saw was the outside finally collapsing. The inside was already sort of hollow, you know?
Oh, yeah, of course.
It doesn't That's... explain what happened as a bulletproof, bomb-proof, Office of Emergency Management on the 23rd floor, because it disappeared too, you know?
Uh-huh.
Doesn't explain anything, really. It doesn't explain the molten metal in the basement. When a reporter in there from Infowars.com, I watched the live broadcast, when a reporter tried to ask a question about Stephen Jones's research into the microspheres he found in the dust,
right.
They cut his mic. They cut his mic and moved on. We're not answering that. And it was, or I didn't say they were not answering it. I didn't actually catch what they said. That's the only part of the whole thing I missed was the response. But I did definitely hear the question. I heard the mic getting cut. So you can see that now on YouTube. It's available. That was
wow.
up right away.
Yeah.
NIST yeah. final report on Building 7. NIST, N-I-S-T. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so Richard Gage, of course, is now following up, demanding the information that they used to reach this conclusion. NIST doesn't want to release anything, as far as I know, of course, you know, because it looked, when you start saying things like unique phenomenon, it makes me think of magic bullet, you know?
Yeah. Well.
Something that it doesn't make
yeah.
sense, it can't be explained. So in this one instance, we don't have to, and the other thing they're saying is we don't have to readdress insurance companies and, you know, building code.
Right.
Because this is unique. It won't happen again. Well, they're
right.
saying fire dropped a 47-story building at 8 floors a second. So
yeah.
because of, it's foolish. And
a unique, yeah.
Yeah. A
yeah.
unique phenomenon.
A unique yeah. phenomenon, yeah. Magic bullet theory. Well, that goes back to when I was citing the poll figures earlier, and I said, you know, I don't understand, but on another level, I completely understand it because, you know, I'm 58 years old, and, as I said on this program before, I have studied off and on with varying degrees of intensity the Kennedy assassination, and I certainly know that even by the 70s, like by the mid 70s, 75% of the American public didn't believe the Warren Commission, you know, and then you had the House Committee say that probably Kennedy was assassinated by a conspiracy, and that was it. You know, nothing else happened. Nobody, you know, I mean, all you had is a coup d'etat, and nobody said anything until Oliver Stone made a film and said, you know, there was a coup d'etat, and everybody said, well, Oliver Stone's a complete wingnut and, you know, whack job. Even though people already know that, and on some level people are quite willing to believe it, but the media is sort of always leading the mainstream media. They always produce these stupid documentaries on the Kennedy assassination, which are always sub-moronic in their content
yeah.
because they always say, oh, well, you know, there are interesting questions raised, but we can't really say
well,
what
they,
happened. Well,
they
I can say what happened, you know.
They never address the new research that comes
yeah.
out.
Yeah, and there's tons
I
of
found,
it.
Interesting about when Oliver Stone's film came out, I didn't really study the Kennedy assassination at all, but when that movie came out, three people died that were pivotal in there died. There was Richard Nixon died that year. John F. Kennedy's wife.
Yeah.
She died that year. Both of cancer, I think. And there was somebody else who died that same year. So that's maybe just a coincidence, but certainly is odd, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because this sort of ties in, but you know, the term conspiracy theorist, I don't think I'd ever heard that term because I was just a kid. But, I mean, I'd never heard that term until the Kennedy assassination. But it's really the most moronic term in the English language in the sense that a conspiracy, conspire means to breathe together. So a conspiracy is officially two people. Is
two
a conspiracy.
Two people that come up with an idea that has nefarious purposes.
Yeah.
That's the total definition of a conspiracy.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time, two people robbing a bank.
Yeah, well, and I mean, what is the conduct of any government but a conspiracy? But it's odd. I thought Dr. Griffin really dealt with that very nicely at the beginning when he said, look, you know, if you're a critic of the official version of 9/11, you're called a conspiracy theorist. But he said that the official version is a conspiracy theory. It asserts that Osama bin Laden directed 19 hijackers to attack the United States by using airplanes. I mean, that's a conspiracy, and it's a theory. And it's not a very good theory because it's not true. But other than that,
there's not evidence to support it either.
Even though I already believed this, I was just sort of knocked out by his presentation as to how, if you really start to dissect, and I mean, I've read the New Pearl Harbor, and I've read to his critique of, I've read the 9/11 Commission report, and I've started to read 9/11 and the American Empire, and I've seen his talks on the internet, but even at that, just to hear him present it so concisely, you just see how many of the different elements are just based on the most, you know, ambiguous at best, and often just completely unsubstantiated evidence, you know.
Mm-hmm. And he really summed it up, and that talk apparently is new too. He wasn't doing that one last year.
No.
So
yeah.
We were really fortunate in Ottawa to see it, and by the number in attendance, there's definitely an awakening happening here locally. So I hope we're helping to make that happen, but I think it's happening on its own. People figure it out. I find that when you talk to people on the street, and the ones who already know are usually people from other countries. They usually are way more skeptical than, we'll say, the average Canadian, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because I talked to one guy, and he had seen stuff like that in his country when he was a kid, you know, that everybody knew it was the government doing it.
Yeah.
And so... So when 9/11 for him happened, he knew right away. You know, he didn't have any evidence to support it. He didn't look into it yet, but he knew. And then within a couple of months, stuff started coming out on the net. So,
yeah, it's interesting in that regard that, you know, the first amongst the Western democracies, it was the Western European countries where most of the original, almost immediate, you know, skepticism was expressed, whereas in Canada, the United States, I mean, Canadians are very close to the Americans on a variety of levels, and I think to the extent that they sort of buy into the, you know, the myth that the American government is in the business of spreading peace and democracy all over the world, whereas other people in other lands have a somewhat more jaded view of things because they've been on the receiving end of the spreading of peace and democracy. And
but we have the same kind of patriotic fervor in Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't put on a red shirt on a Tuesday without somebody walking up to you and saying, hey, how come you're wearing that now? You know, it's just a red shirt. Why does it have to be on Friday? That's brainwashing on some level.
Yeah.
The rubber, or the yellow ribbons on everybody's car.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. They put them on our public... they put them on our buses, you know, on our police cars.
Yeah.
And the problem I have with the yellow ribbon is the yellow ribbon was designed to blur criticism of the current war with disrespect for the troops. And it's what it's done. It's blurred the line, and it was specifically designed to do that. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I say, having lived through the Vietnam War and, you know, being a protester, I know this, you know, line so well. It's, you know, during the Vietnam War, it was like America, right or wrong, and if you were a critic of the war, you were unpatriotic, or you were a friend of the communists, and then wait a minute, we're not an enemy of the American army. We're trying to keep these guys from going over there and getting killed. You know, like, I mean, who's the better friend of the troops? The guys who want to, you know, who want to rah-rah-rah them and then ignore them when they come home or you know, say a few kind words when they come home in a coffin and then forget about them, or the people who want to stop them from going over there and getting killed and from killing. I mean, that's the other side of it, you know.
Now it's come out that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a staged event.
Oh, yeah, that's...
It was declassified.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, you know, I mean, that's
that
long...
That means you were right when you were protesting.
Oh, well, that's, you know, I mean, people know it's BS. I mean, what's not known so much is that there's a very good history of the Vietnam War by Marilyn Young, which I highly recommend, and I think it's something like 30 Years of American War or something. The subtitle, it's the Vietnam Wars, and by Marilyn Young. And in it, what she points out very, very well, better than most books, is that if you really look at who the forces, other than the fact that he was a communist, Ho Chi Minh was first and foremost was a nationalist. His goal was to get out from under the colonial yoke of the French, and he wanted to get rid of the French. And he based his constitution on the American Constitution of the Vietnam Republic. And according to the Geneva Accords of 1954, there were supposed to be free elections. Well, if there'd have been free elections, Ho Chi Minh, he was the George Washington of Vietnam. He would have won the elections, and the country would have been united. It had been divided according to the accords. Well, the American government consistently was the force trying to prop up a corrupt administration in the South, opposing Ho Chi Minh. So when you get right down to it, they were the ones who were opposing democracy or opposing, you know, free choice for the Vietnamese people, and that's the part of the story that never you'll never hear that in the American media. But that's the reality of the situation. You know, they were completely on the wrong side. So not only were they, you know, didn't have any business being there in the first place, but they were on the wrong side. You know, they were the bad guys. I mean, you'll never get that in the American media, but that's basically the fact of the situation. So
at this point, though, I don't even think you can call it media anymore. Infotainment or something.
It's
not. They don't report on real news anymore, and it's so unfortunate because, I mean, these kids sign up, they go, they pay their tuition to go to journalism school.
Yeah.
They think they're going to be the next, you know,
yeah,
Lois Lane or whoever, the big, you know, in-your-face politician, here you go. And it's not the case. They end up talking about Britney Spears or spending 3 weeks. What's the newest one? John Edwards' love child?
Yeah.
That's more people know about that. Or Bigfoot, that was the other one. Everybody
well,
reported on the rubber suit in a freezer.
Listen, I heard reference that the only mainstream journalist who's actually interviewed Dr. Griffin was Tucker Carlson, who's a complete and utter idiot. But have you seen that video?
I have, yeah.
And what was that like? I'm sure that was interesting.
It was all right. Yeah, he's also interviewed Stephen Jones. Yeah, so he did a few times. I don't think he's interviewed anybody recently though. This was a while back.
Okay.
It?
Other than attacking him, did he actually ask him any important questions, or did he actually try to understand what he was suggesting?
Well, see, the problem with David Ray Griffin is as soon as you let him talk, he makes so much sense. So it doesn't matter what you throw at him, he's always got an answer for it.
Yeah.
And the answers make perfect sense.
They're
logical.
Yeah.
You know? Right then, you even saw that when somebody asked him, well, what are you, aren't you afraid for your life? You know,
yeah.
Somebody asked him at the talk, and he said, well, there's how many intelligence agencies in this country? If they wanted to get me, they would get me. I couldn't do anything anyways.
Yeah.
Even that made sense, and he was talking about his own life. You know?
Yeah, in 9/11, the American Empire, his introductory essay, he talks about a little bit about that and says the title of his paper is 9/11, the American Empire and Common Moral Norms, and he talks about as a Christian what it means the idea that you would fear for your life and so you would avoid speaking the truth because you feared for your life. It's not being a very good Christian to do that, you know, which again just goes to this guy's incredible integrity and courage.
Yeah, and he's a true gentleman. Like, I had the dinner with him the night before, and he was, he's so down to earth, he just, you know, you can't, I don't know. He doesn't have a bad vibe in him, I guess you could say. My impression of him was he was a very down to earth, relaxed human being, and it was an honor meeting him. So
yeah, I just very briefly spoke with him afterwards and had him sign a couple of books, and I talked very briefly to him about, like I said, that you know I'm a fan of his
yeah,
philosophical work, and the guy just struck me as. I mean, exactly what I expected from reading his books. He's just such a square shooter, and as you say, there isn't a bad vibe in the guy, and nobody's BS detector would be going off of this guy because he's not a BSer. He's, as I say, I defy anybody to read The New Pearl Harbor and tell me that, oh, this is the work of some sort of conspiracy theorist or any sort of nut, but because it's so demonstrably not the work of a nut that you have to consider what this guy is saying if you want to consider yourself at all informed about this topic. I couldn't imagine anybody reading that book and saying, oh, that's just nonsense.
Yeah. Well, it was actually his first time in Ottawa. He
had
never been to Ottawa before, and loved the restaurants that we went to so much that they went back after the talk. They went back to the same restaurant.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, so I didn't get to attend that. I had family coming in.
Oh, okay.
So, but I wanted to for sure, you know. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it was, and so he did that with, I mean, Connie Fogel was there that night, as were a few other people. So they had, he had a very good visit in Ottawa, which is great, and hopefully that'll encourage him to either come back or maybe tell some of his other colleagues, if they ask, hey, have you ever gone to Ottawa, what do you think?
Yeah.
That they will come down, because it was a very warm reception.
And, Mark.
Oh, I think Christopher's on the line here.
Hello,
hold on a second.
I just called in. I'm calling from Ottawa. I've been attending the Canadian Action Party convention here in Ottawa. And this afternoon we've just heard Connie Fogel's speech as she's stepping down as leader of the party, and there's a leadership on leadership campaign on now in the party, and we'll be deciding a leader, I hope, within the next 3 to 4 months. And we voted a new executive in. And it's certainly nice to be involved with a group of people here, and it's an exciting conference, and to interrelate with other people sharing the same concerns as we all share.
Are there a lot of people there?
I'd say we have about 50 people. It's smaller, but the feeling is there. We just heard a remarkable presentation by one of the gentlemen running for candidate to become the leader. I know I'm going to throw my sport behind him. Excellent individual. I'm on the executive now. I took on the role of responsibility for Aboriginal and Native Affairs. I'm the person in that position in the party, and I may put forward my name to run as a candidate in my Ottawa district.
Great.
So, I'm sorry I haven't been able to be part of the show today. I thought I'd just take a minute anyway to check in. You discussed 9/11 events coming up, Mark?
We discussed the March on Ottawa on September 11th, 2008 at noon at Parliament Hill. There's a lot more to it that I didn't touch upon. Like, we talked about the truth bus, but there's people coming in from all different directions. There's webcasts going to be happening. There's bands coming down for it. So many different people are involved. There was talk about an airplane flying by with a big banner. I mean, they're doing their best to make this thing the biggest 9/11 truth event in history. We're also doing it in solidarity with the event that's happening in New York this year. They are doing 9/11, same thing we're doing. Truthers are getting together, standing up. So we're hoping for the best with that one. So.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show today, Mark.
Yeah, it's been good. We were having a good conversation there.
Why don't you continue on? I'll try to listen in a little bit. I'm on a cell phone, so I don't want to fry my brain too much. We just heard the most astonishing critique of vaccinations. Just unbelievable what's being done to Canadian children through vaccinations. And now all this new evidence emerging, just showing all kinds of these disorders being caused by vaccinations. All of them, not just the Gardasil, but all the vaccinations being to children are decimating our children. The 1 in 6 has learning disabilities now. There's an neurologist, doctor, fellow, and astonishing new findings.
It was a study last week about diabetes in children linked to the shots.
I didn't hear you, sorry. I couldn't understand.
There was a study that came out last week where it talked about a link established between the vaccinations and childhood diabetes.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned diabetes. He mentioned asthma. He says how the toxins in the vaccines attack all different systems. He says it may well be a major cause of Alzheimer's, chronic fatigue syndrome. Like, it causes widespread, I guess it's called organ deficiency. Like, different people have sensitivity in different systems. So different systems might respond to the same toxins. Yeah, it's scary. like, wow, these homicidal maniacs are doing this. He brought up all the facts about how there are almost 500,000 disabled vets from their vaccination programs. Can you believe that?
Well, I never heard that number before.
Yeah, well, over 40,000 have died from Gulf War Syndrome. And then there are 500,000 who have disability claims and such in.
That's terrible.
Yeah, how they're doing it to our soldiers. Yeah, as well as the children. I mean, in the States now, children have 24 shots by the time they're 5 years old. You know, there are a lot of places it's mandatory. I'm at a university now where you have to have an inoculation to attend university.
Wow.
And Algonquin College in Ottawa, the same thing. It's terrible. These people, they're just so heartless. It's really quite unbelievable. But I'll leave that aside. If you guys want to pick up a little bit more, on, I'll hold on for a minute and I'll say goodbye before I leave, but I won't stay on long.
Okay.
I guess we only have a few minutes left here anyway.
Yeah, we're just kind of coming up to the end anyway, and we just discussed a little bit, an overview of David Ray Griffin's talk the other night, and Mark was informing
us. Oh, excellent. Good.
And Mark was informing us about upcoming actions and what's going on in Ottawa, and the March from Montreal, which I think is very, very interesting. And we're coming up on the 7th year anniversary of this madness, you know, and we just can't allow this to continue to happen. It's very clear that this is sort of the defining event of our times, and that really it has to, the lie of it all has to be confronted in as many forms as possible, and thank goodness for the internet as a form that connects people all over the world and allows us to at least discuss alternatives to the official lie. So I wanted to ask Mark if you just had any summarizing comments or anything that you'd like to draw people's attention to. Go ahead.
The David Ray Griffin event, we've already put it up on our website. You can see the pictures from the event. There's a brief write-up, but it's at www.ottawa911truth.com.
Okay.
We posted that event. We post all our truth actions. The event is happening tonight at the X. There's a few people going out that are going to be handing out flyers outside of the X. That will be photographed and posted within a couple days. And this is more of an organic movement. There are people all over Ottawa who are actually getting out and doing these things to raise awareness. And it's all grassroots. Nobody's telling them to do it. They're just, two of them come up with an idea, boom, you know. I guess they're conspiring, you know. But nothing nefarious, just conspiring to get information out. So.
Oh, yeah.
Just for a minute, I've got here the fellow who I was just talking about, who I was saying was standing for leadership in the Canadian Action Party. Maybe I can put him on.
Chris, it's really... Mark, can you hear him? I can barely hear him.
Yeah, I can barely hear Chris.
I'm going to try to arrange him for our next show in 2 weeks.
Yeah, as I say, it's really difficult to hear you, so it's probably best just to leave it.
We'll wait 2 weeks.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah, I would just to encourage everybody to get out on the 11th of every month and do this, make it happen.
Okay. We're just coming to the end here, so I'll thank Mark and Ottawa very much, and Chris, anything to say? As I say, it's really hard to hear you, so I'm not sure it's going to come through, but...
I urge Canadians, join the Canadian Action Party. It's the only alternative. It's the only party that's not a New World Order party. We got to get active and soon. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, Mark. Thanks, BBS Radio. Goodbye.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Mark.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you again.
Okay, have a good night.
Thanks a lot. Bye now. Don, I'm not sure how much time we got left, but just going to wind up here and an interesting session, and encourage people to visit some of these sites that we talked about. I'll give the one in Ottawa again. It's www.ottawa911truth.com, and as Mark said, there are 9/11 Truth chapters all over the place. I mean, they're independent organizations. There's not some central bureau, but they've sprung up all over North America and all over the world. And please check them out. I want to direct people's attention once again to PatriotsQuestion911.com. I urge you to go on and see the astounding range of individuals on there that have questions about 9/11. I was quite shocked when I was going through it. And also pilotsfor911truth.org. That was one of the issues that Dr. Griffin raised in some detail in his presentation, which is that the idea that these planes were flown by people who were terrible pilots and couldn't fly small engine aircraft is totally preposterous, because according to the routes flown according to the official version required highly skilled pilots, and that's one of the reasons why many pilots have questioned the truth of the whole official version. So again, hope you enjoyed the program. And we'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about mystical and esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness, the 9/11 truth movement, and a variety of other issues. And I'd like to thank BBS Radio to Doug and Don for allowing us the opportunity to be on every 2 weeks, and also to urge people to check out the archives of BBS Radio. It's a really quite a repository of a variety of interesting information, and you can gain access to them, and you can hear previous programs, not just ours, but all sorts of people's programs. And I would really urge you to check them out. There's a lot of very interesting information, a lot of very stimulating and provocative presentations on BBS Radio, and we're very lucky that we're living in this time where the technology, at least for the moment, provides us with the opportunity to communicate globally and to cut through the lies and the gross misrepresentation that occurs in the mainstream media. The infotainment that passes for news is pathetic. And if you want to an alternative, check out the internet and check out sources like BBS Radio. My name's Jim Moffitt. Thanks for joining us, and hope you'll come back to Zero Point Radio in following broadcasts, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much. Bye now.